Joel Spreadborough on 612 ABC Radio Brisbane.
It's 21 minutes past 11. Looking into the footy-nomics or the soccer-nomics of the World Cup before midday today. But before that, we've talked or we've heard, if you've been watching the news this week, H5N1, the strain of bird flu that has breached Australian shores. Seabirds in two Australian states. To be clear on that one, this is a flu that can be harmful for more than just birds, basically. We're talking about the potential to rapidly infect other animals and has been doing just that on farms and domestic flocks in the Northern Hemisphere. Turns out it's also deadly to cats. We know that any kind of outbreak needs to be taken seriously, but how seriously should we be taking it all the way over here? According to many experts, now's the time to learn the risks and think about how you will respond. Some are even calling the potential for a wildlife massacre. Heavy words. Let's find out a little bit more this morning. Sam Jones from my local vet has got up, got out of bed and got into studio to help us out. Good morning.
Morning, Joel. I mean, it's 20 past 11, so yeah, you'd want to hope that I got out of bed.
Thanks for setting the early alarm, Sam.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Means a great deal.
A tough Sunday morning.
Your ringtone, just quickly.
What is my ringtone? The Wombles, actually.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. I like that. The Wombles. Mm. That's unorthodox, but it fits.
Yeah, I was born in 76, so I grew up with the Wombles.
Love that. Mm. Let's get serious. It is nasty business, this. We know that these strains evolve. They come, they return, they come back. This one has authorities concerned because it's a little bit, I guess, more potent, a little bit harder to get out once it gets in. How big of a problem are we looking at the moment, in your view?
Yeah, well, I guess, from doing a bit of research, the concerns here are that it's virulence, you know, that it's so pathogenic, meaning it will kill, from what I've read, up to 50%, 80 to 90% of poultry if they are infected with it. And so that's a pretty significant, sort of pathogenic indicator. And of course, there's huge issues, concerns there for, animal production, but also, you know, it can infect all birds. And so there's concerns, of course, for pets. And the potential for it to infect cats is there as well. There is no known cases of cats that have been infected in Australia, but it's possible. And some of these birds, you know, they can actually die before they show any clinical signs. That's how rapidly it can kill them. And the thing is with this particular virus is that, you know, unlike previous avian influenza viruses, this one will replicate in pretty much all tissues, like all of the abdominal organs, definitely the respiratory tract, but the nervous system as well. And so that's why we see these really broad, clinical signs associated, neurological signs, respiratory signs, gastrointestinal signs, so, you know, diarrhea and things like that. It's just, you know, it affects the whole body.
You said we're talking about a very, very quick and very difficult / impossible to detect speed of moving from wild birds to animals. Is it direct contact? We need a wild bird to fly in and come into contact with our pets or whatever they are?
Yeah, I think with the pets it probably is. I don't know. If there's droppings from birds, that they can be infective, and the route through which other birds are infected are, you know, the eyes, the nostrils, the oral cavity. It is possible to be infected through the skin, but you'd need, it's harder. So I don't know if, other than bird droppings, if there is the chance that, say, if you had a bird that, you know, went and dropped a bunch of feathers somewhere or something, another bird would get it. But certainly just from reading about, you know, the possibility that it could transmit to humans, it seems that it's a bit more challenging for the virus to infect humans. It can do it. Mm-hmm. And the fatality rate in humans is up to 50%, I think 43% or something like that is up there. Yeah, so I think, you know, definitely if there's anybody that's dealing with poultry, you know, as a part of their occupation, or has, you know, their pets, birds, suddenly get really sick and die suddenly, then that would warrant, you know, a phone call to the animal emergency hotline to just check and see, am I best not to touch my bird?
Yeah.
You guys happy to come and pick it up and investigate? It's the Emergency Animal Disease Hotline, sorry. So I've got the number for that. It's 1-800-675-888. Because, you know, there is some potential for humans to get infected.
1-800-675-888, that one if you do have any concerns. As you say, I think the standing advice is do not touch an animal that you think might be infected, just out of an abundance of caution as much as anything else. But on that point of it being difficult once it's active to detect, what can we do? Are there any obvious kind of signs that might spark concern?
So because it affects so many different tissues in the body, they're very broad. And I guess if you have poultry, you know, chickens and that sort of thing, typically the signs that you might see would be respiratory signs, so, you know, coughing or difficulty breathing, laboured breathing, and a reduction in egg laying. But they might be more subtle to just those birds being subdued, you know, not very active, or they can present as being sort of in shock. And what birds do when they're in shock, it's just as bad for birds as it is for humans when they're in shock, but they'll just fluff up essentially and be pretty still. And so, you know, to the untrained eye, you might just think, oh, geez, looking pretty fluffy this morning, but actually they might be really unwell. Mm. So that's the sort of bird side of things. Cats, neurological signs, respiratory signs, so that would be something to look out for. Same sort of thing, you know, coughing, sneezing, difficulty breathing, laboured breath, that sort of stuff. And then, you know, all the other animals, I mean, not that anybody's got any pet foxes in Australia, but foxes can become infected. And, you know, obviously the other animals that I mentioned are seals and sea lions, but the dairy cattle in Australia in the US have been infected. So, you know, there's I guess concern that that might happen in Australia as well, which would be a huge impact to those farmers.
Sam Jones with you, my local vet, and very much appreciate the info you're bringing this morning, Sam, on this topic. And look, we're just scratching the surface as far as the biosecurity side and the actual measures being taken at the moment. Do jump online to find out more if you do have concerns. But Sam very much highlighting some of the obvious and some of the not so obvious signs to look out for. Julie makes a good point on the text line, and this might not be our area of expertise specifically on this strain, but talking about, I guess, the spreading of it through secretions. She's talking about, we know that bird poo can grow trees sometimes when it's dropped in places. Is it transmissible? Do we know, I guess, via those kind of means? Carol adds to that saying, bird baths, the things that, you know, an infected bird might just drink from a bird bath, that sort of thing. Do we know anything along there?
I think based on general principles, I would say yes. I don't know how fragile this virus is. It would be something that would be easily researched, I suspect, because, you know, the influenza viruses have actually been around for a very long time, so there'd be a fair bit known about them. And my suspicion would be, yes, that it's quite likely that there's bird secretions in a bird bath, particularly, you know, when you've got a lot of birds going to a bird bath, that there's no reason why it wouldn't potentially transmit to another bird, you know, and that bird bath could act as a fomite. That's sort of the technical term for an inanimate object that transmits disease.
That's quite dangerous too. You mentioned foxes before too, and again, you know, pet fox was on the Christmas list. Santa never came to the party on that one, but they get around. We live down in Logan area here south of Brisbane, and we've seen the odd fox early morning on the driveway. Just, g'day, mate, just seeing if there's anything for me to you know, scavenge here. Mm. They're everywhere. My point being, again, contact, getting around. So that transmissible potential, not from birds, but from a fox, from a cat, from a cow, whatever it is.
That's a really good question. And I wouldn't want to speculate on that, because I think that viruses will need some specific kind of attributes to be able to move from, you know, from a bird to a human is one thing, but to a bird to a fox to a human is sort of like another thing altogether. And I don't know whether that is possible.
Okay. Well, go, jump online, find out more. It is an active issue at the moment. As I say, two Australian states have confirmed cases of this particular strain of bird flu. It's an aggressive one. Sam has pointed out some of those symptoms to prompt concern, and just confirming that advice is, if you see an animal that you think is infected, to not touch it, to call that hotline 1-800-675-888 to take instructions from there. But basically avoid contact, exercise caution. Now, Sam Jones with you at 31 minutes past 11. You sent a text the other day, Sam, basically doing my job for me and much better than I would ever do it. You brought up a topic that I actually really, really like. It's around the idea of vet transparency, basically the concept of what does your vet do with your animal in front of you when it comes to vaccinations, nail clippings and the like. And I'd never really thought about the ethics of that or about what the standard should be if a vet disappears behind closed doors to administer a shot or anything like that.
Mm.
Top line from you: when it comes to transparency, what do you do? Do you feel you should be treating animals?
Well,
you
know? Well, I guess born out of personal experience with if having had clients come to my vet practice that had been to other vet practices and for whatever reason, you know, trust had been eroded in their previous with their experience with their previous vet, I had received comments from some clients saying things like, you know, oh, they took my pet out the back and they said they did a blood test, but, you know, they didn't really believe them. And whether or not that was what they genuinely felt or they were just upset with that vet, who knows? But when they sort of started saying those sorts of things, I thought to myself, you know what? I wonder whether, you know, we should try and offer a greater level of transparency so that people can feel like, first of all, they've got more control, they can see what's going on, see the value of what you're doing, the technical expertise required to take, you know, blood from their pet and then run a blood test and those sorts of things. So, and it wasn't just a blood test. There were a few other comments that other new clients had made to me that really made me realise that it can be an issue not having a level of transparency. So henceforth, we sort of, and that was probably about maybe 7 years ago at my local vet, we decided to try and make it as transparent as possible. And what we found was in doing so, it actually conferred a significant benefit to the pets as well. And by that, I mean, so we would start to say, okay, let's start taking blood in the consult room with the client present. Unless, of course, the client said, look, I'm a bit, you know, I have a needle phobia or I'm worried about blood or something like that. And a vast majority of clients, though, are happy to do that. In fact, we then started giving them a role to play, which was essentially talking to their pet or massaging their pet's face whilst the nurse and the veterinarian or two nurses collected blood for a blood test. And what we found was for those pets, it was significantly less stressful.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe wonder, well, gee, why did we start taking blood, you know, out the back in the first place? It's just one of those things, I guess, that came with the training at university. It's like, you know, you need sort of enough space and the resource and that sort of thing. But so, we started doing that. And certainly all of, you know, giving vaccinations and those things we have always done with the clients present.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there might be occasions where a veterinarian might read the situation and think this particular client might be a bit sensitive. Let's say if it's a young dog and it hasn't really had a vaccine before, a needle or something, and sure, we try and distract them with treats, but that dog might yelp just with the feeling of having a needle. That if it's a particularly sort of sensitive client, they might just decide to take the pet out the back and do the vaccine because it's just less stressful for the client. But I think overall, most pets would prefer to have their owner with them to distract them, if nothing else. But certainly they find it comforting, I think.
I'd assume it would be, based on my own pets, the default would be to be in the room because you say, you know, they might get a little bit distressed. We're talking scratching, gouging, you name it, basically, if they're not calm in those kind of moments. Is there any sort of, on the vet side, look, I'm a bit worried about this. It's a little tiny animal. It's so cute. I don't want to hurt. What if I stuff this up? I better just go behind closed doors. Or is it, do you think, entirely patient-focused as far as...
No, I do think there's some element of that. Certainly for, well, I could speak from personal experience as a recent graduate. You know, you just haven't injected that many animals. Yeah. You might have done two dozen or something. But, you know, this is the thing when you're dealing with animals, right? They can have all sorts of responses to being injected. And in the early days, when you're first starting out, yeah, you might want to get some numbers under your belt in the privacy of the treatment room, let's say, where if a patient did react by, you know, pulling their head out of restraint and try and bite one of you or cry or something like that, it just takes the element of stress out of the vet to have to worry about what the client's thinking. They can focus purely on the actual delivery of that medication by injection. So I think there is a place for it, you know. And you eventually sort of grow out of that and eventually are able to do that with clients present, and you can feel just as comfortable. So, and I must say that there are some patients that do benefit from not having the client present. Mm-hmm. There's some patients that I find it's almost like, in fact, I think it is, them feeling like they've got to protect their owner.
Yeah.
And so they take a defensive posture, to, even though obviously we're not doing anything to the owner, but they feel that they're protecting, you know, their owner, and so they'll become reactive towards us if their owner's present. And so sometimes what I'll say to the client, I say, look, I can see he looks really anxious, he's got defensive posture or whatever. Why don't we try this? You just step outside. I'm going to chill with him a bit on the floor. So I'll lie down, give him some treats, you know, try and give him a pat under the chin or whatever. And I encourage the client to look through the, we've got this sort of peepholes. It's a bit like the sort of peephole you look through someone's front door, but it's much larger. It's like a TV screen. And so they can watch everything. So they still have, the transparency is still there with their pet. And I sort of make friends with the pet first. And then I would say a lot of the time with those pets that were trying to defend their owner, they are, you know, we'll have a nurse in there with them. The nurse will hold and I'll give the injection and they're fine. So it just depends, case by case. Mm.
It's interesting that. It really is. It just isn't a topic that had come up, but I realised over the years different vets it has been a little bit different, but it's not a question I've ever kind of asked. So I suppose when we're looking about the animal stress factor, our own stress factor, and the vet's execution factor of making sure things are right, it's not like a mandated thing you have to stay in the room. But I'm sure if you said, oh, I'd prefer it if you stayed here, the majority of vets would say, okay, sure, we can do that. It wouldn't be a big
sticking point. Absolutely. I think you just got to work with the client, you got to work with the patient. And, you know, if a vet felt like that wasn't going to be a great idea, then they would have to have a conversation with the client about that. So this is why I think your pet's going to be better off without you in the room, you know.
Sam Jones, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Joel.
Thanks for getting out of bed early once again.
I'm going to go back to bed now, mate.
Go and rest up, mate. I got you out at 11 o'clock. Yeah. I've got one little gift for you before you go, if this works for you. This is for you, mate.
Not another phone call. Thanks, Joel.
This is Sam's Wombles ringtone. Hello, Sam speaking. Thank you, mate.
My pleasure.
Thanks for inspiring us all this morning with some cool ringtones. Just a little bit more of that for you.